Oh, there we go. Welcome, guys. There was a slight problem with YouTube there. yeah. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to our regular Thursday stream. My apologies for the quick silence there. There seemed to be a problem with YouTube, but I delinked OBS and linked it back up, and we're back. Yes, we are indeed back. The reason you can't hear Evelyn is because she isn't here, unfortunately. She is a bit ill with a bit of a cold right now. I know there's some people who who look forward to that sometimes, but no. It's Evelyn is a valued asset to the channel, and quite honestly, I think this is the first solo stream I've done in rather a while, so I try and not let my voice get hoarse. But yes, God, I have noticed as we go through the preamble here that YouTube has been horrendously unstable. I had chat crash on me a few times. I came on the back end, chat wasn't there. I had to pop it out and repop it in. I got the Monkey of Doom. If you've ever seen the Monkey of Doom, sometimes OBS just doesn't link up with YouTube properly, or YouTube just doesn't link up with the OBS properly. But anyway, enough talk of the technical details and why we had maybe 30 seconds of silence there, which I will cheekily probably trim off in the VOD, although this is a little bit of an indicator. If you're not hearing 30 seconds of silence, it worked, although that does take like 2 days, because YouTube's processing is very slow. Am I forgetting anything? The weather, yes. The usual preamble does include what the weather is right now. The weather here is a balmy 6 degrees, and it is absolutely tipping it down. It's really, 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 really rainy here. So it's raining sideways. let's get to some of our normal stuff. If you guys want to support the stream, we do have the Ko-fi available. There are a few people who have donated between shows. Don't worry, I have seen those. I'll do a quick thank you. The problem is, thank you to everyone who did donate between the show, but a lot of you donated using your real name. I had a couple of PayPal and a big Ko-fi donation. You guys know who you are. Thank you for the donations. I don't want to read your real names on stream, so I won't do. But if you guys do want to do that, the best way to support us is via the Ko-fi. Yes, it is. It is a rather moist day. It's very, very moist. And of course, we'll be going over the Substack, because this is kind of a jumping off point and why I put Evelyn in the thumbnail, even though she's got the cold. F for Evelyn and her cold, by the way. Although, like I said, she will be here in spirit. The reason is that this is based on a post from back in February, just called Stop Demanding Free Speech, and its follow-up, which I think about 10 people read, unfortunately. Sometimes they just don't take off. It's called The Internet and Its Consequences. We'll get to those. But really, this is a bit of a wide discussion about, well, the utility of free speech, and really whether or not it does have particular utility, because it's one of the things that occupies a huge, huge space in the dialectic. God, the layering's gone a bit funny. There we go. Something that offers a huge space in the dialectic. This isn't a New Britain. We've had New Britain there for a bit, so if you're wondering why there is a pint of Theakston's sat there, it's just to be comforting, because quite honestly, this stream will be, I think, a little uncomfy for certain people who have certain assumptions about how the world works. But yes, we'll get into it. I put here playing into the myths of history, and that really is a core part of the problem with demanding free speech. Before I get into some of the more specific examples and get into some of the writing and stuff we've done beforehand about free speech, it's worth noting that the free speech framework and the language of free speech and where a lot of the activism side of it comes from is the 60s. It is the myth of the 60s and the myths of history. A free speech discourse is also based upon this laughable idea of the marketplace of ideas, where ideas are evaluated by homo redditus, as I put it. To read a quick excerpt here from the Stop Demanding Free Speech article over there in the Antipolitics Substack, do go visit. As outside political causes were given free rein to influence campus activities, the all-encompassing student activist experience that higher education is sold as now formed over the preceding decades or the following decades. So the first point to note about free speech and the language of free speech is a holdover from the activist days of the 1960s. It very much fits in the framework of the civil rights era. It's a large part of the myth of that era, the myth of the 60s, that there was this stodgy old 1950s regime that wouldn't let the poor students speak. It wouldn't let people say what they wanted, and people protested on campus for civil rights and free speech, and then the world became better. it's just pure nonsense. I don't think anybody here really buys into the myths of history as written. I know my members certainly don't. A quick segue there. Thank you, Anthony Keane, and thank you, John Morton. I see you there in the chat. And there's a couple more members who sometimes lurk as well. So we are still fully monetized somehow. So if you do want to support the channel via YouTube, please do. But this is something we've gone over before. We don't want to repeat ourselves too much with this. But I think one of the best worked examples in all of this, really, is the... there was probably a bit of audio over there. But one of the best examples I think we have in the moment is the fact that we've had a blossoming of speech, let's say, around about immigration. We have the small boats discourse. We have the framework of what we refer to as, as performative failure. A lot of stuff has happened this week in terms of UK politics. I know a lot of people were kind of hoping we'd talk about this, but we did talk about this already. You can talk about what you want, you can have what you want, you can have the conversations you want, you can even have people come out and positively support some of the causes that you want, but it doesn't matter unless something comes of the speech. It's a very, very simple example, but it would have been unheard of 3-4 years ago to have a conservative politician talking about the fact that migrants are full of hotels. Hotels are full of migrants. Migrants full of hotels. Migrants the size of Talbot. No. But the hotels are full of migrants. That was consigned to the dustbin of conspiracy theories in many people's minds. But really, we have this week, just 19 hours ago, Robert Jenrick resigns as immigration minister over Rwanda legislation. And we have talk of the migrant hotels. Here he is again back in October. The migrant hotels will close. Rishi Sunak is currently beating his chest about immigration in a way that people are slightly baffled by, because there's so much talk of immigration, but there's not really any action on immigration. And as we get into this discussion a bit more, it is worth noting that you can have a very, very open and honest dialogue about immigration and still have all of the implementation paralyzed. The biggest problem with demanding free speech is that all you're doing is talking, and we'll be reiterating that in certain ways and hammering that point home as we move forward. But anyway, to get back to the point of the myths of history, it really is kind of a tainted way of trying to appeal to the regime. It's trying to use their language against them, but this is their language. The civil rights activists were the good guys in the 60s. We'll be just like them is the mindset, the really boomerish mindset you see when you get to people trying to do this right-wing free speech kind of thing. And to be fair, people like the LA Times here, and here's an article, an archive of the Washington Post, but going over as well, they're right. They're right, really, that these second-hand activist pants do not fit the political right. they're not something that naturally works with them. And really what they're doing is they're adopting the mindset of the leftists of yesteryear. Here's the headline: Berkeley gave birth to the free speech movement in the 1960s. Now conservatives are demanding it include them. Here's a little picture there. And that's where the thumbnail comes from as well. It comes from the Berkeley protest, which allowed all of this space to develop, where people were talking about leftist causes rather than the core of their academic subjects. That really was the thrust of the free speech movement in the 1960s. And it was done quite cynically, as we'll get onto, but I'll just read a smidge of this. University of California at Berkeley has spent the week entangled in a controversy after it cancelled a speech by conservative provocateur Ann Coulter. Man, she's gone away. Remember Ann Coulter? Then reversed course Thursday and announced it would allow her to talk on campus early next month. The decision to prohibit the speaker at any public university would have triggered criticism, but at Berkeley, a symbol of campus free speech in America, it meant much more. Again, They are playing into the accoutrements and the myths here. They're going, well, it's Berkeley. Berkeley's a bastion of free speech. What about the 60s? And really, all that does is surrender to the myths of the 60s. All that does is surrender in the same way that Ronald Reagan did in the 1980s by making MLK Day a federal holiday. It surrenders the right completely to the 60s left. It means that you really are just a 60s leftist claiming that the Democrats are the real racists. And as we go through this, there'll be a couple of memes here that I'll be getting up. But there's one I've made here. there's a couple here. This is this really is the essence for me. It is the marketplace of ideas. We'll be bringing the various marketplaces of ideas up as we go along. But the appeal to free speech is also an appeal to the marketplace of ideas. It is an appeal to this mythical sense that there is a conversation to be had, that if we can all have open and free debate, that merits will reassert itself, that we will have all the merit in the world, and really all you end up with is, as I said, homo redditus. You end up as man as redditor, which we'll there's a little quote at the end of this stream from the last part of the last of the articles that are on the Anti-Politics Substack, which I think really, really sums that up. But here we go. We have two competing ideas of the marketplace of ideas. We have the quote-unquote right-wing marketplace of ideas with all the acceptable ideas of James Lindsay and the anti-woke crowd and Turning Point UK waving their Israeli flag because, well, as we all know, we do indeed love the nation of Israel. And we don't say our affirmation these days. We let Nigel say it for us. Take it away, Nigel, before we get demonetized for not praising.
You may think it's complicated, but be clear. A sovereign state of Israel has been attacked. War has broken out. For decency, we must stand 100% with Israel.
Thank you, Nigel, there. Thank you very much. But the banner of free speech, the affirmation is necessary. Affirmations will continue until monetization. No, wait, still monetized. Affirmation will continue until algorithmic popularity improves. But the banner of free speech has only ever been used as a form of narrative control. Before the 1960s, conversations around freedom of speech and the way we think about them now weren't possible, because really there wasn't the idea of the quote-unquote public square in the same way we have today. There were intellectuals and there was people's private lives and what people said, but really there was not, pre kind of 1945 especially, apart from obviously the lockdown in ideology during the wars and the lockdown in society during the wars, in the 1920s and 30s and before that in the 1910s, and we had societies in which, I know we live in a society in which this conversation didn't make any sense. We had a civilization in which the idea of arbitrating what was and wasn't an acceptable belief in terms of politics seemed like nonsense, because really politics was something that was supposed to be the purview of the individual, or at least the purview of the inside of someone else's mind. the political debates around free speech, in quotes, are really about trying to dominate the conversation with your own speech. Free speech in the abstract is impossible. It doesn't work. And that really is the crux of it here. Unlimited free speech, as we think about it in kind of the internet activism sense, is simply unfocused noise. Not everyone has something worthwhile to say. That's the real crux of it. The myth of anarchism and the emergence of good baked into the free speech discourse are one and the same. The ideas of anarchism are, if you remove all the limits on human behavior, you remove all structure, all hierarchy, all duty, you end up with a perfect society because of these emergent phenomena. That really is the logic of the unlimited free speech. Free speech in itself is an absence. It is an absence of conversational parameters. It is an absence of moral framework. It is an absence of hierarchy. It is an absence of ideas in many cases. It is simply an ethereal subject. And if you become a quote-unquote free speech maximalist, you end up with, well, as we've talked about in a previous stream, well, not a stream, but, oh God, I'm getting my language all mixed today. It wasn't a stream, but it was the video I did with Trig, if I get rid of these marketplace ideas, which was the four eras of 4chan, the first episode of It's Okay, We're From the Internet. And we really kind of do go in on the delusion of the emergent conversation in that, because I was part of the early online activism, really, I'm afraid to say. I did have a little bit of a foot in Chanology, and that taught me really that online activism and quote-unquote the free speech absolutism of someone like 4chan didn't have permanence. It lacked permanence. It could be powerful in a moment, and it could create culture that could be harnessed by other people, but really it did not create an organized minority, which is really what we're looking to do here. So if you think about free speech tactically, rather than just as an abstract concept, unlimited free speech is just, as we talked about, pissing in the sea of piss. Rival castles can be destroyed using free speech as a base to create unrelenting noise with no space for structured organizational hierarchy. Many people, when they saw like what was happening in fandoms, this is really what happened to things like tabletop gaming, or feminist in my video games, but any community. It happened in the atheist community, it happened in a lot of the scientific community, in that you have these activists who come in and demand that they're able to talk about their specific activist subject, and then you have another group of activists in, racial activists, come in and say, you end up with, yes, unfortunately, I'm very cringe. The reason I'm doing a lot of this is to try and atone for my past cringe sins. but anyway, you go into, they go into spaces like, let's say atheism and atheism plus, for example, if any of you remember that. You end up with a form of free speech, in quotes, based consensus cracking, in that suddenly your atheist movement is talking about feminism and people feeling uncomfortable and intersectionalism, and the conversation gets derailed. You can get nothing done, and you end up being overcome by the endless conversation because unlimited free speech, in quotes, lacks specificity. The next kind of simple point is really is that it's an outgrowth of the very online mentality. I know we're on the internet here, but it is really some of the internet and its consequences has been a disaster for the human race, because it gives people a very warped idea of their own individual contributions. It gives them a warped idea of their own voices. It gives them a warped idea of their own relevance, and it gives them a warped idea of their own intelligence. I'll repeat it again. Very few people have something worthwhile to say. And one of the main delusions that the internet has brought on is that we can have this amazing, unlimited, free conversation that brings us to a utopian idea within the aforementioned marketplace of ideas. I'll put that back up there. This is really where that mindset ends, though. that mindset ends with the kind of the James Lindsays of this world. They keep picking on him because he deserves picking on. It ends up with classical liberal atheism. It ends up with you having a principled defeat, really. The internet and its consequences is to bring people into the mindset of principled defeat, and if not, just absolute babble. Just meaningless noise. Of course, the next principle would be, well, what are people free to say? In the 1960s, activists followed the trail set by lawmakers. There was a very real and clear idea of what those in power wanted to be said. And that could not be imposed through the ideas of the old institutions, but had to be imposed through this push for quote-unquote free expression, as described above, which creates spaces full of noise, or it creates spaces full of your speech. It is in service of a goal. I find it odd people talking about, again, free speech in the abstract, because it's not a concept. It's a buzzword, but it's not a concept. It's like, okay, but what fills the space? What are you free to say? It's like the whole thing where everybody thinks that they're going to be the king of Ancapistan. It reminds me of that. Everybody, when free speech is realized, when you have this perfect world, the perfect dialectic, everybody thinks that they are going to be kings of the wasteland. Everyone thinks that in an ideal free speech world, their ideas are so good that they are so clever and they'll be able to put them across, everyone will clap. You know, finally, the politicians will hear the words, they'll hear the based words and they will repent. They will have a road to Damascus conversion to being based, and the world will be a paradise. If only we could have the freest of speeches. And obviously, it's a fantasy. It's a complete fantasy. It's a complete fantasy to think that you are going to end up as the dominant force when it's been shown time and time again that those who already dominate the conversation have much more resources than you. And before we ask for free speech, we should think about what we're going to say in it. And we should think about the fact that really there is no unified idea of what needs to be said, of what needs to fill this space once the activist grip on the conversation has been removed. If you simply say, well, we want a level playing field, you know, we want the best ideas to win, we want the marketplace of ideas to be real, you'll just simply be dominated by the same people who dominate it now because they have the most resources and they have used them to dominate the conversation. Again, it's like the old joke about Capistan, that really what happens is the people who have... You could declare on Capistan tomorrow, but it'll last for a nanosecond because the resources in people's hands won't change. As an ideological concept, it doesn't hold any weight because who declares when free speech has happened? That's really kind of another point there. But there's not really much thought been put in as to tactically what will be done with this freedom of expression. In the 1960s, a lot of these activist groups were led by the CIA, which gave them a huge amount of kind of coordination in what they were saying. The opinions of the quote-unquote woke students are the same as the ones annoying their elders, according to the Los Angeles Times article. But they're right. What happened was a group of people came in and started saying insane things, but basically a large part of the power structure said, you should be listened to, you should be taken seriously, and as is put in the original article here, the Stop Demanding Free Speech article, it is framed around the kind of high, middle, low of the Juvenilian model. It's quite simple to explain, really. You have the power structure, who are the high people, they're the people on high, the people in power, reach down to a third group, a periphery, a group of people on the periphery, the activist class, the emerging activist class in the 1960s that is being fostered by the intelligentsia. And what do they do with it? They use it to create this myth of bottom-up action, when really what you get is top-down. This would not have been possible. The march through the institutions, quote-unquote, via speech, free speech, would not but have been possible if the power structure was against it. AA has made some good stuff before about the fact that law is upstream from culture, that culture is downstream from law, that really in the 1960s, the legal changes happened first and the cultural changes happened second. But if you realize that, you realize that the idea that the institutions were taken over by activists who were going, free speech, let us speak, it's nonsense. You're not able to do this. You're not able to go into a space, demand to be taken seriously, and have it happen, because that's not what happened in the 1960s. And it is true that there is a continuation line here between the activists of the 60s and the activists of today. There is a through line within kind of the post-war politics and the quote-unquote post-war consensus about ever further frontiers of civil rights. And you can't defeat the frontiers of civil rights with civil rights language. You can't beat the civil rights framework within their own framework, because they're the ones who created it. They're the ones who control it. And you can't just run around saying, I want to speak the Democrats, the real racists, because that is just a recipe, as we've seen by the shape of reality, to lose. If you don't have a cohesive message curated by an organized minority, you fail at the first hurdle. Well, let's keep going here. The next question, of course, would be, well, who controls the free conversation? The answer from the anarchists would be, well, no one does. It's free. We're free. We have no masters. But anyone, again, who lives in reality knows that any kind of specificity in conversation requires there to be a division of labor, or at least a speaker and a listener. If you have complete unlimited conversation, all you have is a million voices saying a million things. You have a deafening cacophony. And so for there to be free speech and a conversation to take place, there must be a subject matter. There must be somebody who sets the conversation. I know this sounds really, really, really basic, and it is really, really, really basic, but it's not something I think people have really thought about when they try and use the language of free speech. Because it's not something you can magic out of thin air. It's an abstract concept, and the realities of it don't seem to be well thought through. Here's an example. Lawsuit intensifies spotlight on free speech controversies at UC Berkeley. And it's the wrangling over the conversation we see now. There's a lot of legal and political energy being spent trying to inherit the crown of the activist class. And as I said earlier, all you end up doing is allowing them to control this conversation, because you are having their conversation, you're not having your conversation. So really what we should be thinking about is, how do we get our points across? A lot of people think that quote-unquote free speech is the first step towards that, but it's not a step towards anything. It doesn't put us in any control. It doesn't advantage us in any way to simply demand free speech. Because you can have free speech and you can still not have control of the conversation. It's a very, very simple game to play. If you have a clear plan for narrative dominance, you will dominate your enemies. But if you don't have a clear plan, you will be dominated by those who do. Level playing fields do not favor the best ideas. That is a delusional myth. They favor the people who have the most power. And I hate to break it to you, but you are not the class of people who has the most power in terms of your ideas. That's not how this works. Tell you what, I'll try and get. Can I get these two up at the same time? There we go. That's the overlay. I'll resize these a bit so I can get them to sit next to each other. Because I don't know. I had a good time making these. These were kind of funny. See if you can pick up some of the. Some of the memes put in there, but anyway, God, that's my resizing's terrible today. It's a bit of a resizing moment, but there we go. I think that's the closest we're going to get for now. But I do enjoy mocking the marketplace of ideas. It's very easy to make fun of. It's not something I've really ever had much time for, and I cannot believe that this all still persists. I can't believe we're still having this conversation. But this conversation and the conversation around the marketplace of ideas and around debating and winning over your enemies continues because of this mindset. And I know to a lot of you this will be an uncontroversial stream, but to many people who are still inculcating the previous version of quote-unquote the online right, this will seem like heresy. There's a lot of people who are very uncomfortable about the idea that you can't just be a principled advocate of free speech. It's the idea that you just want to be, oh, you just want to be right-wing SJWs. It's like, well, we want to win. My main question is not, do these abstract ideas work with other abstract ideas to create a theoretically perfect world on paper? That's not what I'm after. I am after a victory state. I would like to see my enemies defeated and my friends in ascendancy. That is ultimately what it is. Friend good, enemy bad. And if you adopt that mindset, then the marketplace of ideas is just funny. I just find the concept so amusing. And yes, living the dream. I'm just so sick of living in 2016. One of the earlier streams on this channel was called It's Not 2015 Anymore. It's Not Current Year Anymore. But people don't seem to realize that, which leads us to really just creating content like this. Here's a second little excerpt of the Substack piece this stream's based on. Thank you, Evelyn, for being here in spirit. But it's the result of a decades-long campaign of free expression in Western academia has come at the expense of the ability to teach the Western canon of literature and knowledge in a positive light. Well, here we are with the dead white men framework. And I am using a Simpsons frame there where Miss Hoover tells Lisa to stop dead white man bashing, and this is why the rest of us can't find husbands. It's meant as a joke, but I thought that was pretty based. But it's true. This is the end result of the March for Free Speech. This is the end result of 1960-style free expression. And this is the mantle that people are trying to adopt. They're trying to adopt the mantle of the dead white men crowd. They're trying to adopt the mantle of the people who invaded the educational space, really, with this free speech framework and used it to utterly, utterly salt the earth in terms of the Western canon. The destruction of the Western canon was done under the auspices of free speech. That is how it was done. That is how this was cracked open. And in leaning into that as a moral argument, you're leaning into those people as the good guys. I think the separating line here really are the people who understand what happened in the 60s and the people who still go think that MLK was a hero. And again, a lot of people find that statement very controversial, that Martin Luther King was not indeed a beautiful American hero or indeed a magical Negro. He was neither. And his celebration and his codification as basically one of the new founding fathers of America blinds everybody who is not able to break out of the myths of history. I think the free speech framework as we have it now is one of the great, you know, in terms of scale, not great in terms of good, but one of the big outgrowths of the myths of history that still persist within the world right now. It is kind of boomer truth writ large. Even a lot of people who say they don't believe in boomer truth will still make offhand comments and repeat program slogans about free expression, free speech, and freedom of thought. When those things do not benefit them in the slightest. Ah, dear. But I'm just baffled by this. And, of course, free speech is a zero-sum game. It is, your speech will always come at the expense of somebody else's speech. There is only so much dialectic space in the world. There is only so much space in the world for people to speak. One message must come at the expense of the other. One form of speech must come at the expense of another, or it is simply the aforementioned white noise. Someone must be in control of the conversation for a coherent conversation to take place, just like someone must be sovereign for a nation state to exist. Cooperation requires a clear hierarchy. And I guess that brings me back to some of the mantras for surviving modernity that we did. Because really this delusion about free speech, the free speech delusion, is based on not understanding first principles, or at least not understanding or not applying first principles properly. I'll put us back up there on our little Substack piece there, but we do use the Substack to kind of prototype some of our ideas. It's somewhere we've not had much output recently, but we do use it to try and figure out what does and doesn't work in terms of our kind of behind the scenes ideas. We'll maybe create a document at some point that's kind of like the codified Scrump and Evelyn manifesto. Not in that way, but kind of a guide to what we believe, what we don't believe, what we think is practical, what we don't think is practical. But an outgrowth of that really should be the fact that if you look at the theoretical, rhetorical, free speech war of all against all, it doesn't allow cooperation, it doesn't allow hierarchy, it is anti-hierarchy, and therefore it is anti-cooperation. It is not the start of the conversation. Quote-unquote theoretical unlimited free speech would be the death of the conversation. Just like anarcho-capitalism is laughable, and is laughable in all the right circles for a reason. And a lot of them have been laughed out of the room, even more so recently. I think that politically, there has been a moment where that was popular, say, kind of 2016, 2019, people huffing their political farts, but that moment has passed. But people don't look at the free speech framework in the same way. They don't look at quote-unquote unlimited free speech as being anti-hierarchy, as being anti-cooperation because of that. And also of just being unworkable, of just being a blind ideal that people don't think through. But it persists. I've had this argument with so many people about trying to mobilize people. I'm so, oh, well, of course, we just need free speech. Well, we just need free speech. It's why we kind of have issue with people like the Free Speech Union, because what they end up doing is they just end up suing various educational institutions to basically allow them to have former Marxists be able to speak freely, or radical feminists. It's not a ideological or practical push I think is worthwhile. I don't agree with some of their methods in terms of how they try and quote-unquote temper certain people's speech. They've talked about that before. They've talked about how you can be in the Free Speech Union, but you can't use hate speech. And they very, very slyly like to use the term lawful speech as well. Lawful speech is used a lot in all of the literature surrounding the Free Speech Union, and that is a big red flag to me, because all it means is that they will not defend you if you are doing what the government defines as hate speech. So they're wrangling really within the acceptable limits already set by central government. And again, it is just haggling. You end up just haggling with your masters in the free speech conversation rather than seeking victory. And I can't stand the fact that people celebrate, say, medium-sized payouts for unremarkable activists or radical feminists who don't agree with the latest push of gender ideology. I mean, fair enough, but they're still radical feminists. How is a radical feminist being given £50,000 by the civil service to fuck off a victory for the online right? Or you know, the right in general. Never, don't forget the, never mind the ball pit of the online right. How is that a victory for us in general? How does that further our aims? How does that bring us closer to a much more naturalistic and hierarchical world? How does that take the boot off our neck? It doesn't. All it does is creates a false victory. It creates something that people will celebrate that they have no right celebrating. That's why I can't get behind that. I also think that Toby Young's a fucking Tory boy, and he worked a lot with central government and has a lot of suspicious connections. But anyway, where's that gone? I've got my little chart here as well, which I'll put on screen. There it is. I don't use this enough, But this, how do we measure if free speech is quote-unquote beneficial, or how much free speech we have? And it really comes back down to the framework of the therapeutic state. We have all of this academia, we have all of these people saying that we have a healthy conversation, that we do have free speech, that we have a conversation and a dialectic that makes good things good and it makes bad things bad, and it makes good things more and it makes bad things less. And you end up with the more gooder. There are always going to be limits on what you can say. Everyone always talks about the shouting fire in a crowded cinema. Everyone always talks about threats to kill and illegal speech. There are things that you will say that will always make you fall foul of whatever authority, whatever time period you're in. There are always going to be things that you cannot say that will genuinely be dangerous to other people. Again, the fire in a crowded cinema examples, what everyone likes to trot out, but still, there will always be limits on this. So it's about what the limits are. It's about who sets the limits. It's about how you foster the conversation. And if you buy into the myth of a neutral conversation, that you can have a purely neutral place to have a conversation, it's, again, it's mythical. Where is this? Where has this neutral conversation ever taken place? Where has the marketplace of ideas ever been established? Where hasn't it been up to these therapeutizing academics who come out and say, we've got free speech, free speech has been achieved, it's 1980 or it's 1990, we've done it, guys, we need to set the limits here, we've done it, we've established the correct Overton window, in quotes, even though to a degree I think the Overton window itself is still a myth, and we've got it. The bad line's going down, the good line is going up. I hate to keep repeating myself, but it's utter nonsense. But this is the framework you put yourself in if you continue demanding free speech. Ah, dearie, dearie me. There's a few sections of this and a few things I want to point out in the actual article that I think are very, very relevant. I'll get the little graph off there and get the window capture. But this is from The Internet and Its Consequences, published in February. God, that was quite a while ago now, February this year. Tell you what, I'll quickly get back up the thumbnail, because some of you may recognize who that is. This is the thumbnail for the piece, not the thumbnail for the video, but some of you may recognize who that is in the corner there. Do you see him? Have you found him there yet, in his little Mario costume? I think this is one of the only pieces of media for the recent streams or Substack I've made that has Filmo Roberto in it, who has sadly become slightly more internet obscure these days, but I do quite like my Movie Bob memes. But that's kind of by the by. This is kind of the outgrowth of where the conversation goes and what happens and what people do with their free expression. Because TikTok has become, it's become the social media platform of choice for many people in the age of 25, for most people in Asia, for many people in America, for a lot of Europe, to the point that it ends up warping the social space. What you can see here is hundreds of Chinese streamers sitting under a bridge at the edge of a rich gated community, so their geolocation will serve them to richer clients. This is the emergent phenomenon of the online town square. These are the consequences of the internet. You have hundreds of streamers with their ring lights sat under a bridge pretending to be in a rich neighborhood so they'll get geolocated and served to richer people. Everyone who thinks that there's going to be a cant on every street corner, a John Locke on every street corner if we end up with free speech, to paraphrase Bowden's thoughts about the myths of Marxism, should take a look at what the online platforms are actually used for. We've been given the largest informational tool in human history. We've been given all of this unlimited access to knowledge. And this is what people do with it. It is TikTok. It is Twitter. It is endless noise. Endless trash. And Asia's some of the worst for it. But this is their outlet. This is their free expression. This is what they have chosen to do with their voices. And it's pathetic. we have tried to build ourselves a perfect online world with perfect access, where everyone is equal, where everyone's able to speak, and all you end up with is people trying to cheat geolocations by sitting under a bridge. These are the consequences of the internet. But before I get into a little bit of a more of a freeform thing, there's a little bit here I wanted to read, because the last paragraph of the article, again, Evelyn wrote this, but is absolutely blistering. And I think this kind of sums up my thoughts about, one, free speech, and two, how free speech is used on the internet. The legacy of free speech as a concept outside the civics classroom and the chatter of unserious politicos will be one of misery. When its name is no longer being invoked, when its name is not being invoked during the attack of a group on an institution or Western intellectual heritage as a whole, it has produced a maddening cacophony. All the knowledge we could ask for, all the sights and sounds have been recorded by our fellow man. Access to all of it has been reduced to less than nothing. There is no barrier for entry. Internet man is a know-it-all. His arrogance is detestable. He is a fervent materialist atheist. The facts and the science are his pantheons, and they are all at his fingertips. Ready and armed, he engages in battle with his religious and reactionary foes, as he is in the right. And all the information, all the studies, all the chatter tells him he's right. Dueling, physical competition, hairy pub brawls, if only instead they have argued about Kantian ethics, Roman prehistory, or whether Michelle Obama is a man. Ignorance really was bliss. I'm going to double check and make sure I've not missed any donations for a second here before we start rounding out a bit. Bit of a shorter one today because of the lack of Evelyn, but I do see I have a couple of donations. Thank you for the £2 there, Coney Current Year. Thank you very much. He says, keep up the good work, friends. Thank you, Mr. Current Year. That Mint 20 with the $5 there. Thank you, Mint 20. I guess the lesson is, once again, stop trying to use the weapons of the left against them. It's their weapons and they're immune to them. Well, to a degree, it's not that I don't think we should use the weapons of the left against them. It's that I don't think people understand the weapons of the left. People's commitment to free speech in the 1960s, for example, was not genuine. They understood that this was a consensus-cracking method. They did not believe in free speech naively, they believed in it cynically. I believe we can use the language of it sometimes to our benefit. I believe that appealing to it sometimes has benefits, but we should keep in mind, really, that it's nonsense, that we're playing into a delusion. Lewis Shaw Morritt, thank you for the £2 there. He just says, ooga booga. I will answer that with a big snood. A big snood there. But it's they never bought into it. They never sniffed their own farts. It's very clear that their commitment was having their conversation take over, having their ideas take over, having their people able to speak, and fuck all the rest of y'all. That was their mindset. But it's something that, again, they've not only bought into the leftist mindset, they bought into it naively. They've bought into the outer party element of it. They've bought into the PR of it. They've bought into the lie of it. And it is a lie, and they know it's a lie. That's why when they took over these institutions, the first thing they did was pull the ladder up behind them. When they were enabled by those in power, and it was a top-down change, to go in there and smash up the conversation and replace it with their own conversation, the first thing they did was remove the free speech because it had served its purpose. Free speech, as a dialectic, is a cynical tool. It is a way of using any powerful friend you have who can leverage you a space in an institution to destroy it. But you have to have an in. And really, from all of this, people have not drawn the correct conclusions. And that's what it brings me onto here, is the conclusions from this. Because I think, again, some of these will look familiar from previous streams, but we can glean a lot from this. And really, we need to move beyond mere speech, is the main conclusion from this. The endless conversation goes nowhere. Even if you do establish free speech, all you're doing is widening the endless conversation. If you get what you want, if you get your perfect free speech world, then you just have endless chatter. Because free expression in the abstract is powerless. It's about the expression. It's about the content of it. This is not quote-unquote value-free. In a value-free analysis, free speech looks terrible. It's about what you do with it. It's about creating space for yourself. I'll repeat myself again. Most people have nothing worthwhile to say. Empowering people to speak doesn't create this great plethora of great ideas. All it does is make Chinese people sit under a bridge on TikTok. The big lesson, though, for people who want to do the reverse march through the institutions is that hard power beats soft power. The reason that the left were able to use the language of free speech as a cover to muscle their way through the institutions is because they had powerful friends within the government and the structure itself. It's very clear from what happened subsequently and what happened kind of at the time as well, now that we know what was going behind the scenes, that none of it was organic. That there wasn't this great push, that free speech itself doesn't have power, that power has power. Free speech is soft power, and it can only really have an effect with the assistance of hard power. And simply trying to counter the combination of hard and soft power that the regime currently wields with our own soft power is completely misguided. And the last one is that the masses are powerless in the face of the organized minority. Free speech itself is a revolution of mass and scale invention. It is something that we think about in terms of mass societies. It's a mass society invention. It's part of the mass society mindset. And the masses are powerless in the face of those who are able to organize against them. As we always go through, first principles, the organized 100 will beat the disorganized 1,000. The organized 10 will beat the disorganized 100. You can't brute force this through a mass mindset. And the idea of free speech is a mass mindset. It's an idea that you will empower the masses to speak and therefore good things will happen. And it is raw delusion in terms of how power works. You cannot have a mass leaderless, emergent, distributed movement. You end up with anonymous. You end up with Occupy, you know, you end up with being represented by people called Parsley and, you know, Expoctos and all of this terrible stuff. The idea of this diffuse, leaderless, emergent conversation that comes from the miracle world of free speech is just, it's counter-propositional to everything that we've gone through. If you watch a lot of our content, you'll probably be asking me why I'm making this, because from a lot of the stuff we said, it should be obvious that free speech doesn't matter. It should be obvious that free speech is a spook. But again, the lie persists, and the lie persists is because people don't have the correct mindset when it comes to power. And I don't see it going away anytime soon. It's a very seductive conversation. It's a very seductive framework to put yourself into. That's why really we find ourselves over here in our own little kind of corner of the internet in many ways. We are sat on our own and we've got a few allies, but really our mindset is so different from many of the other people who engage in a rightward online, I guess, content creation, people who consider themselves as right-wing content creators. The vast majority of them will tell you that, yes, free speech is a good thing. Yes, we definitely should have free speech. Free speech is good. People, the enemies of free speech are bad. And if you don't want your enemies to have free speech as well, you're just a fascist. You're an authoritarian. Authoritarian isn't bad. Collectivism isn't bad. Individualism's good. We're all going to run around and we're all going to be, you know, this guy. We're all going to sit at our marketplace of ideas stall in our Kekistan t-shirts saying that the Democrats are the real racists. I know I'm being glib here and I'm making fun of people, but this is just what I see. And I know it's something that a lot of people will agree with, but I'm sick of seeing it. Why is it still here? Why is this mindset, as easy as to parody, still so prevalent? And it's because we still exist within our enemy's framework. And as long as we exist within our enemy's framework, we will not find any sliver, any small amount, any crumb of victory. I will say thank you, JW specifically. Sorry, I've been hunting down some of the stuff for the £40 you sent via PayPal. Thank you, that's quite helpful. Again, I will thank our members. I will encourage people, if they do have any couple of spare shekels, to go over to the Ko-Fi. Do check out the Substack, because the Substack is where the original version of all of this is from. It stopped demanding free speech and the internet and its consequences, which has been a disaster for the human race. I should probably link one to the other as well. I've got a bit of stuff to do. God, we're so busy these days with other stuff. I'll have a quick look through chat for any questions. If you have any donations, get them in now, because we're kind of in the last 5 minutes here, I'd say, really. We've come to a nice rounding off point, but if people do want to ask a few more things. Thank you, Lewis Merritt Shaw, saying, oof, listening to this in the gym. It's fair enough. A good job of being in the gym, though. People should get more healthy. I've actually lost... I was on medication last year that caused me to bloat up a little bit. I was on the equivalent of prednisone, but I've lost a lot of weight recently, and I've been trying to encourage people in the right to be... to be a bit more health-minded, a bit more health-conscious. It is something that people should do. To go off a bit of a tangent here, you should go out and get fit if you can. You should make sure that you are healthy, mostly just for longevity reasons. Like, being fat's really bad for you. Don't be fat. Learn from me, because I've lost like 3 stone. to be fair, I was about 6 foot tall and 6 foot wide. But gym is elitist. Yes, gym is elitist, and elitist is good. We should be more elitist, and gym is good. Do get fit. Don't be fat. Apart from that, though... of course. I will be not quite sure when it will be going up, but I'll be recording with James Dellingpole tomorrow, and Evelyn should be there as well. We will be on the Delling Pod. I know there's probably some people who listen to that. I'm 5'11", okay? I'm the king of the manlets. Sorry, people are making fun of me in chat. it's 6 foot tall in 15 quotes. No, but we'll be on James Dellingpole's show, though. We've been invited on. I did see that a few of our pieces of content were linked in his Telegram channel. So thank you to James for promoting some of our stuff. I think it was the people around him, the people who run some of his stuff who have. But still, thank you to James Dellingpole and his people for promoting our stream. And thank you in advance, unless you're watching this in the VOD, in which time has become unstuck, and we are the recorded voices within your computer. Hello from inside your computer. by the way, you're looking at a screen. I pulled that one out on a few people, but unless you listen to it in a podcast in which you are listening through headphones or speakers or other stuff, the point kind of lost its impact there. I'm trailing off, and I'm going to stop before I trail off too much. She's Healing Spirit, guys. Thank you to everyone who donated. Thank you to all of our members. Thank you to everyone who keeps this strange and slightly esoteric sometimes project running. Once again, we have the outro music here, thanks to Nick Madison, who I may or may not be streaming with at some point. A distant content creator who makes a bit of music. I thought I'd use this space to promote people a little bit. So do check out his stuff. He's linked in the description, and also I put him in the chat there. Thank you to everyone for turning up. Sorry, I'm slightly scattered on my own. I'm used to having Evelyn here to pick up the slack and prevent my horrendous dry mouth, because I need about 10 cups of water now. But anyway, thank you guys for listening, and have a good evening.
What it do, y'all? Nick Madison, 2023. I'm sitting on the couch with a full bowl of cereal. I manifest a tempest, pulled from the ethereal. I learned to make a choke from the Sith and the Imperials. Became a rapper's worst nightmare, made material. Coming out from underneath the sink, feeding on your fears. Gobble up the clowns, rinse it down with the cold beer. I don't even need to lift a finger. I could still linger around inside your brain when I'm slain. Would you hold me?